First, I would like to thank Pierre Huyghe for his very kind invitation, and Jenny. And tonight with you, I would like to proceed to some kind of double movement of thinking that could be maybe a theoretical image of Pierre Huyghe's work for people who already know the work of Pierre Huyghe, at least as I understand it. I do think that one of Pierre Huyghe's major interests, and one of mine too, lies in the idea of intensity, of variation of the real. Well, beyond true and false, good or bad, if you want to qualify the unquantifiable, you speak about intensity in general. This is, I think, the key concept of the contemporary mind and the key concept to the contemporary utopia or dystopia of the liberal world. In commercials, for example, intensity is used always as the ultimate value. If one wants to evoke the action of a product on our senses, well, it should evoke intensity. Dior intense, intense chocolate, Red Bull intense, burn intensity, well, you know, all that kind of stuff. But think about extreme experiences too, even in sports, higher, faster, better, stronger, and so on. Intensity. Even in love, passion is viewed in the contemporary world as intense love, in sexuality too. Even in arts, in vain activism, in contemporary happenings, intensity seems a more accurate description of the aesthetical process and experience than beauty or truth, and so on. For example, Alan Kaprow was already talking about intensity, about Pollock. Why is it so? Why do we need intensity to describe our very contemporary experience? What is an intensity? I do think, and we will see little by little that this is a point, I do think that intensity is a promise of the contemporary. An intense experience, that means a non-flat, a non-depressed experience of life. Each time we are prompt to live our lives intensely and to make the most of fleeting but powerful moments, or to charge with intensity our existence threatened with platitude, depression, or dissolution, what we understand by intensity is nothing but the possibility, without changing anything in the world, of comparing it to itself and of suddenly finding it better or more powerful than it really is. Maybe this idea of intensity is the ultimate ideal of the contemporary mind. Yet, isn't it absurd to compare the world or something in the world to nothing but itself without any mediation of an idea, an ideal, a norm, a representation? I think that the contemporary mind no longer wants its sensations to respond to preconceived ideas. It wants to be surprised by sudden intensities. And when one no longer recognizes natural or cultural criteria, when one no longer has any ideas, ideals, or representation in order to appraise the beautiful in everything, there remains no other path for the aesthetic sentiment than to relate something, an artwork, a face, a landscape, to itself, and to try to find out if it's still possible to find it strong or weak. In other words, to feel whether what is there in front of me is more or less intensely what it is. And the incessant appeals in the contemporary world to indulge in powerful experiences and to think something intense in artworks and in life signifies nothing but the non-recognition by the contemporary mind of a criterion of value other than that of the comparison of a thing, an individual, an event, or a sentiment, not with another, with a norm, with their ideas, their concept, but with itself. Intensity, let's say that as a first definition, intensity is a pure relief of the self. everything is more or less, everything varies, increases and decreases by itself. It's not more or less good, beautiful, true. It's more or less what it is. It's more or less intensely itself. Nothing is supposed to be substantial. Everything is supposed to be intense. And as we will see, I think this is a common misjudgment of the contemporary mind to think that everything is intense. For example, as Deleuze said, you know, in the Anti-Oedipus, everything should be interpreted in terms of intensity. We should think that this sentence, for example, could be a good way to summarize the contemporary mind. Everything is intense, or everything should be intense. But if everything was indeed intense, nothing would be intense anymore, because there would be no possible measure of intensity. If everything is intense, as it's promised to the contemporary mind, something at least has to be deprived of any intensity. I think that this is a very contemporary depression. Everything is intense, so nothing is anymore. Let's reverse the sentence. Well, if we really want some intensity, we do need a point of non-intensity, because the paradox is the following. If we really want everything to be intense, because we want to be faithful to the contemporary promise, well, if we really want everything to be intense, we need something to be absolutely non-intense. This is what we could call the Archimedean point of modernity, a hypothetical vantage point from which an observer can objectively perceive the subject of inquiry with a view of totality. You know that Archimedes claimed that he could lift the earth off its foundation if he were given a place to stay, a place to stand, one, only one solid point, and a long enough lever. If we really want everything to be intense, we do need an Archimedean point of non-intensity. That's why I would like you to follow me now in a theoretical journey in two parts. First, what we will call a katabasis. Second, an anabasis. Katabasis, as you may already know, is a descent or a military retreat, like moving downhill. It's a trip to the underworld, too, like Orpheus or Odysseus' trip to the underworld, for example. Katabasis is sometimes used, too, to refer to depression, the katabasis phenomenon by Jung, for example, in psychoanalysis. Anabasis, on the contrary, is a going up, like moving up the hill, going back to the surface, okay? Katabasis, anabasis. Anabasis, like in Xenophon's work, anabasis. You remember maybe the expedition of the Greek against Persia, anabasis, going in the country, from the coast to the country, from going up the hill. It's anabasis, katabasis, going down the hill. What I propose is first a katabasis of all intensities until the naked something. So first, we will do something like an ontological katabasis, depriving all things from any intensity and going down the hill of being. A sort of speculative move to the things and to something deprived of any intensity in the underworld of objects. Then an anabasis from the something, the naked, non-intense something, to the variable intensities of time and the living of multiple objects. That katabasis and anabasis are, to my opinion, the only way to escape the impasses of reaction, modernity, and postmodernity. And this is what I see when I look at Pierre Huyghe's work, an endless katabasis from intensity to flatness, and an endless anabasis back to intensity to recover the very sense of intensities in a world where anything can be equally, no more, no less, what it is. First of all, let's go down in the underworld of things, of entities without intensity. What we will try is a theoretical catabasis from intensity to non-intensity, to the no more, no less. The no more, no less, we will call that the something. We have to go down until we reach something without any intensity. Just something, no more, no less. The question in general which interests me is the simplest one. There is, what is something? No more, no less. That's a common question in contemporary philosophy I'm sharing with other philosophers, such as Graham Hermann, an object-oriented ontologist. But my starting point is pretty different from theirs. I start from the following ideas. We could say that the contemporary is a promise of absolute intensity, of absolute more and less, while modernity was a promise of things, no more, no less, just something. We could say that the contemporary, in general, is an anabasis with no end to absolute intensity, while modernity is a catabasis to the something, to things, but an endless catabasis as well. The division of labor, the industrialization of production, the computerization of all data processing, the specialization of the knowledge of things, and above all, the desubstantialization of these things, which for a long time, as you know, in the West, were organized according to essences, substrata, qualities, predicates, quiditas and quoditas, being and beings, and so on. Well, they have brought about a kind of singly contamination of the present. It becomes rather difficult to preclude anything from being equally, no more, no less, something, neither more nor less than any other thing. We do live in this world of things where a cutting of acacia, a gene, a computer-generated image, a transplantable hand, a musical sample, a trademark name, or a sexual service are comparable things. Well, that could be, you know, one of Bruno Latour's litanies, as Jan Bogost once called them, or even a new kind of Borgesian list by Jorge Luis Borges. That means a non-hierarchical enumeration of things, of entities, with no ordering of genus, species, or classes, like in the antics, or like in pre-modern and modern thinking. Just things equal things. Some resist, considering themselves, thought, consciousness, sentient beings, the person or God, as exception to the system of interchangeable things. I do think this is a waste of time and effort, for the more one excludes this or that from the world of things, the more and better one makes something of them, such that things in general have this quite terrifying structure. To subtract one thing, to subtract one of them, is to add it in turn to the count. My first hypothesis in our catabasis to the thing will be that modernity, in the greatest and most vague sense of the term, constitutes an answer to the question, what is something? And my hypothesis will be that everything in modernity was demonstrating that each thing is something. Let's suppose that we can imagine a modern ontology of the thingness of anything that would be sufficiently liberal to, first, conceive a world open to any entity. Second, to conceive that degrees of difference do not exist between entities, and that entities are all equally what they are, with no intensity at all. This ontology would welcome all entities, possible, impossible, real, half entities, it doesn't matter, all entities without discriminating against them. And we could therefore qualify it as liberal. The liberal ontology is clearly a catabasis from more and less, from hierarchizing the cosmos to some kind of singness, equal singness. We will try to suppose that all that is truly modern in art, in science, in economics, in politics, has been accomplished both on the founding of such a liberal ontology and in the hope of contesting it. This hypothetical modern liberal ontology consists in considering everything as being equally something by attributing to all entities in the world an equal coefficient of, let's say, ontological dignity, in the manner of that which is nothing more than a thing and nothing less than a thing. This hypothetical liberal ontology both elevates that which was on the side of the status of the thing and abases that which was beyond it. For example, the attributes of substances were treated by modernity as things equivalent to what they are the attributes of. In a letter to Vuillard, the painter Maurice Denis expressed his longing to no longer paint a red sky, but, he said, to paint a sky red. What does it mean? The red quality of the substance of the sky can become substance in its turn and transform the substantiality of the sky in quality. The result of this upside down of predicates and substances in modernity is a triumph of the thing as an average and common characteristic. The sky is something, red is something too. This is the end of the cosmos as we once knew it. The disappearance of substances and attributes, therefore of an order of more than things and less than things. From simple qualities, from little, from nothing, a liberal ontology makes something. And from substances, from much, from all, in fact, it also makes something, no more, no less. Everything that created an order separating things from what is not completely a thing or from what is more than a thing has disappeared. As a general rule, we will say that everything which was a more than thing, everything that constituted a totality like God, the world, the soul, ideas, but also man, life, being qua being, history or society, all these things were in one way or another objectivized. In other words, one made an object of them and one disconstructed the claim of each to be non-refiable. It was possible to make an object, for example, of a human person, as it has been theorized since the Enlightenment, just as it was possible to make something of God, consciousness, or life. Everything based on metaphysical arguments seemed to benefit from a status of a more than thing that was gradually lowered to the level of a mere thing, something, not everything, and not nothing. One could argue, for example, that consciousness was not something because all things are given to us in consciousness, as Husserl would say, for example. But society and history made consciousness a something like other things. Can remember, for example, a famous program in the 70s called called Natural History of Consciousness, making consciousness a natural thing like other things. But one could argue that at least history wasn't something because all things took place in history. But history was also constructed as something in consciousness or in a particular society, which elevated to the rank of myth, according to the ethnologist, for example, to Lévi-Strauss. And rather than the higher form of all things, history was also found to be something which one could moreover be wary of, in which even the claims of history were necessarily historicized. As in the German ideology by Marx and Engels, one could argue that society was not something, but the condition of everything that was given as something for us. However, in the naturalist view, think about Wilson or Pinker, for example, society also appeared as a particular thing, determined, for example, by the more general evolution of life and of animality. Society had a beginning, conditions of appearance, limits, and therefore the status of a finite object. One could argue in the same way about man, God, being, the will to power, or life, by Bergson, for example, Bergson explaining why life is not a thing. Well, in modernity, all these more than things, all these conditions of things, saw their claim humiliated, and something other than themselves always reified them, exposing their limits, determinations, and particularities, before subsequently reducing them to the rank of a particular thing in an infernal chaos of thought. Everything that made things was made a thing. As if you know, the executioner was condemned to be executed by an executioner immediately forced to be subjected to the very same fate. On the one hand, what was considered a less than thing, what appeared to depend on substantial things or on material things, ended up acquiring a status independent of a mere something. On the other hand, everything that seemed to be a more than thing was lowered to the rank of thing. The 20th century thus passed on what could be called a flat world, in which any criterion of a thing seemingly no longer subsists, and in which this thing is no longer constructed by different ordered degrees that a metaphysics would be in the position to infer and absolutely justify. This observation remains, no matter what can be something. We experience this idea daily, and it's maybe the characteristic property of our world, a world of things where nothing is intensively something, where anything is no more nor less something. Well, this immanent modernity of liberal ontology is opposed to a second modernity, which comes to cover it over, namely critical modernity, in the sense of Kant criticism, as well as the critical theory of the Frankfurt School, in the sense of the critique of French theory, as well as Husserl's crisis of the European sciences. We could define the critical mind as the one which is opposed to the universal inclusion of things. I am not a thing among things. This is a claim of the critical mind. Operations of the critical mind therefore consist in excluding something from the aggregate of things. However, modern critique finds itself confronted with an enemy more powerful than any it would want to oppose. The negative expenditure by Bataille, for example, evil, the tragic, the transcendental, intentionality, the sacred, were systematically recuperated in something more. And I think we do know this scene of modernity and postmodernity well. This is a logic of recuperation. All that which is accepted is incepted. The negative is transformed in the positive. You attempt to accept something from things, but in accepting it, you have made something from it. The power of reification therefore corresponds to what I will call the epidemic function and anti-critic function of things. A thing subtracted from a count is one more thing. The victory of the simple something without any intensity, the non-intense something, it's a victory without contention. There exists a superior ontological power to which the modern critical spirit is condemned to submit itself, by which it gives over to things that which it delivers from things. This power is all the stronger as it is passive. There is no factory of the thing in modernity. Well, the thing is a common work of things, as well as that which seeks to accept itself from common thingness. And this is a drama of the modern mind. The stronger that which it opposes to things will be, the greater the loss will be, since it will transform into a thing what it will exclude from things. This is the power of the concept of thing. That which one accepts from things, one makes something of. The negative as well as another thing. For the concept of thing is in reality so unintense and so weak that a thing of less is immediately a thing of more. Every effort of the mind to exclude something from the field of things paradoxically accomplishes its inclusion in this field. The sacred, taboo, but also the efforts of logicians in the 20th century to remove the contradictory objects from the field of the existent things invariably leads to the constitution of these entities in things. The singular power of the thing is related to this system of extreme weakness opposed to thinking. We thus define the something. It's that which, when denies it, is affirmed as much, neither more nor less as when one affirms it. It's therefore a determination so weak that its negation equals its affirmation. Well, let's redefine modernity once more. We could say that modernity is a discovery by the mind of an ontological power weaker than the constraints of the mind itself. This power is one of the something, the absence of intensity. For this reason, what we call liberal ontology can seem properly irresistible. Contenting itself with following the movement of the reification of all that which comes, it suffices it to endure the status of the thing no matter what it is, and liberally accept through the doors of the world all that is of it, confirming that it's something, whatever it is, what it is not being the question. Well, in modernity, the critical mind seems therefore to be the one which is condemned by default of weakness and not of strength. Critique is always too strong for something at work in its own history that we have identified, for want of anything better, as liberalism. But I think which has a superior historical scope than classical liberalism, which will systematically get the better of it by weakness, openness, and liberality. The critical mind can well persist in countering rampant reification by a value, transcendental, an absolute, or the negative in general, yet it commits a strategic error. As of long ago, it believes it gets the better of it as strong mind, even so it finds itself confronted with a weak liberal ontology whose epidemic diffusion leaves it short, condemning it to err retreat by retreat, magnifying the defeat and contenting itself with the position of glorious loser. I think there must exist a way for thinking that no longer opposes itself in vain to what comes to it without turning itself into it. There remains a power in the mind, akin to speculation, which is a capacity for the acceleration of thought. That speculative power is, I think, the only chance of our catabasis to the something. Well, if we can accept that there is something like a liberal ontology at work in history, then we are taking it seriously. We no longer work to oppose ourselves to it, like critics, but to confirm it and to accelerate beyond itself to some point of rupture. The mind must wager whether liberalism can ever live up to its own ontology. The mind, rid of its historical, social, and real constraints, should trust in its power of abstraction in order to show itself to be more liberal than the most liberal of liberals, up to demonstrating that the reification which is at play in history is never at its own level. Supposing that there is something like an ontology at work in liberalism, take note. Liberalism never keeps its promises. Historically, liberalism is always split between, first, an ontological promise which diffuses itself in modernity, the promise of breaking open all the constraints on the entities of the world, of excluding nothing and endlessly multiplying possible singularities, and second, economic and legal necessities which value strong constraints, the conception and the defense of the person or property. In other words, it's necessary to distinguish two modern powers, a power of weakening all constraints, an ontological liberalism which accords an equal dignity to all that is something, whatever it is, and a power of reinforcing certain constraints which are the conditions of exchange, of property, and of responsibility, a political, economic, and legal liberalism. Well, liberalism both accelerates the weakening of all constraints and values the resistance of certain economic and legal constraints on entities. Working against itself, this liberalism makes critique sometimes its best ally, since critique accomplishes for it the necessary work of the deceleration of its own process, which stabilizes it. Thus, what an absolute liberality promised to the mind by way of world, an open world where all things could be equally singular, never finds an end. For real history both accelerates and decelerates its process in never finishing it. This is a cause of the fatigue of the contemporary mind, which is condemned to function in emptiness, at risk of provoking the pure and simple return to an order, to hierarchization of things, to the desire of renewing with a strong ontological constraint. There exists, and there has always existed, I think, thoughts of strong ontological constraint, whose purpose is to order, to classify entities by placing them under condition, and thoughts of weak ontological constraint, whose purpose is to comprise the most entities possible, making an abstraction of their condition, of their reality, of their truth, of their materiality. Modernity has been the putting under condition of all our representations, submitted to weak constraint, opposed to the strong constraint of what was presented as pre-modern thought. Let's pose the following idea. Our liberal ontology corresponds to the diffusion of a thought of the weakest possible ontological constraint, which recognizes no a priori constraint on the entities of the world. Breaking with all ancient, classical, and pre-modern thoughts, with a strong ontological constraint which organized the cosmos under condition, the epidemic diffusion of things would attest to a work of weakening the constraints of thinking. That with which the mind fights would no longer be a body of condition and strong constraints in the organization of the world, but a spontaneous weakening of all constraints, an ontological liberality. We can reformulate the task of our katabasis in the following way. Rather than opposing thinking of strong ontological constraint to critique liberal ontology, is it possible to propose a sort of ontological constraint weaker still than liberal ontology itself? To which it's necessary to add a second question. Does a thought of the weakest possible ontological constraint exist? In other words, is there an end to the weakening of the ontological constraints of thinking? If there is an end to reification, to the process of singularization of no matter what, if it's not about an endless process of dissemination of being, then the mind can still imagine going quicker than this liberalization, showing itself weaker, reaching its end, and from this end, showing the semblance of liberality, of real liberalism, that it's not liberal enough in relation to speculative ultraliberalism, that it doesn't keep its ontological promise, which is betrayed in the name of economic or legal constraints. We take the wager that the mind can imagine being ultra-liberal to achieve the end and pass to the other side, to see another world, to show the other world at the end of the katabasis to the most open and liberal possible world. In order to do this, it's necessary to reverse the perspective of all modern and pre-modern thinking, of all thinking of strong ontological constraint, whose purpose, from Aristotle to Spinoza, was to define a discriminate existence. It's no longer a question of finding some criterion which allows us to discriminate between existing things and non-existing things by choosing a just determination of existence, like materiality, reality, non-contradiction, count as one, etc. On the contrary, it's now a matter of finding the criterion authorizing the attribution of singular existence to anything, and therefore of not discriminating between these things. The approach is reversed. It becomes important to no longer to find a criterion strong enough to decide between, for example, existent and non-existent being. but a criterion sufficiently weak to not distinguish existence or non-existence, or more exactly, to distinguish the least possible inexistent in the world. We pose the question, what criterion would be weak enough, while remaining a criterion, to distinguish the least possible inexistent thing? How to read the world of its determination and variable intensities? We ask if it's possible for thinking to find a maximal determination, a determination of being so weak that no determination could show itself weaker without then becoming a pure and simple indetermination. The task of metaphysics is no longer, as in Leibniz, for example, to think the ens perfectissimum, God, so perfect that nothing more perfect can be conceived, nor even the ens minimum that is sometimes evoked by Thomas Aquinas, but of thinking the ens infirmissimum, to be so weak that nothing weaker could be conceived. Let's begin the operation, our operation of katabasis to the weakest possible determination of being, which is something. Right away, we can renounce materiality, spatio-temporality, or naturality. In effect, it's a matter of very strong determinations. If only that which exists materially, spatio-temporally, or naturally exists, then we should consider that sub-things, secondary things, illusory or false things exist. We will neither be materialist, nor spiritualist, nor naturalist, nor constructionist, nor nominalist, nor idealist. We will prove nobody wrong, but prove everybody right. We accept the existence of the singular, but also of the general. We presuppose that each apple, that each tree exists, as the idea of the tree also, neither more nor less, no intensity. What we seek is not true existence, nor real existence, nor absolute existence, but only the best shared and most equal non-intense existence. For entities supposed false, illusory, fictional, as much as the ones which are estimated to be true or real. We therefore separate materiality, naturality, or space-time as determinations of being too strong to appoint the end of reification. What determination could show itself to be the weakest? Non-contradiction? Once more, we do not confirm that this criteria isn't pertinent, but that it's simply too strong. If the minimal determination of existence was non-contradiction, it would be necessary to accept that contradictory objects do not exist at all, and therefore that we are not capable of attributing a certain minimal existence to these contradictory objects, like a square circle. If we accept that there's a minimal determination which distinguishes one contradiction from another contradiction, and that all contradiction is not the same contradiction, then we will recognize that a contradictory thing is sufficiently determined, even if it follows, no matter what, from a contradiction, because ex falso quod libet, a contradiction is not no matter what. All contradiction is something and something distinct, weakly distinct, certainly, but distinct all the same and therefore singular. It's something. Let's pursue our katabasis down the hill of being to the underworld of the naked something. Could there be some weaker determination still? Maybe unity. It would then be necessary to think that everything exists as it is one thing. Even a contradiction is a unity. Perhaps impossible, but the unity all the same of two concepts, such as the circle and the square. Unity would therefore be a determination of existence weaker than non-contradiction. And unitary existence would be the weakest determined existence possible, therefore the most widely shared. A being is one being, as Leibniz once said. But is it necessary to link singularity to unity? As weak as the determination of unity could be, it's still not certain that it's the weakest possible, because unity is a form of singularity which still contains a certain degree of particularity. To be one is always to be one among other possibles. For this reason, we can presuppose that there is perhaps a determination weaker still than unity. We'll try to name this determination at the end of our catabasis, down the hill of being, which would not allow a thing to return in a count, but which would subtract the thing from it. This determination would not even determine the thing to enter into an aggregate or theory. It would not authorize a count as one, since it prohibits anything other than it. This is what we will call ontological solitude. This solitary existence is less determined than unitary existence. By the solitary existence of a thing, we understand the minimal determination of its singularity. The determination of existence being that in which the thing that exists is, we'll say that a thing is solitary insofar as it is in no other thing. One sole thing is a thing which is accompanied by no other thing. The sole thing cannot be in another thing, in which case there would be two things. The sole thing is in something other than a thing. It's not in itself. There would be two things as well, but outside of itself, alone in the world. This equal and exclusive solitude of each thing, of my finger, my hand, my finger at a time, my finger at another time, me, a unicorn, square circle, the idea of me, all of us, half of me, just a part of an atom, etc., etc. This equal and exclusive solitude of each thing is a minimal form of singularity, which is the end of the determination of things and therefore the end of ontological liberality. You cannot conceive a more open, liberal world than this one, than a world of solitary things. The paradox is the following. The more open possible world is a world where there's just one thing at a time, because each thing is solitary. So in this world, anything can be something, but it can be something if and only if it's the only thing to be something. So this is a world that is quite poor. You have only one thing. It's not a lot. You have one thing at a time, but absolutely no matter what can be that thing. So the more open the world, the less things there are in this world. So the end of our catabasis, which is the end of the ontological liberalism, which is the end of the promise of modernity, is a world so open that absolutely anything can be something. Half a thing, a contradictory thing, a fictional thing, two things, three things, a non-thing, the impossible, a contradictory thing, and so on and so on. But there's a price to pay. This thing can be something if and only if there is no relation between things, if and only if the thing is alone. So you have only one thing at a time. That means that equality of the things is exclusive. When my finger is something, nothing else can be something. When my hand is something, nothing else can be something. So when my finger is something, my hand is not something. When my hand is something, my finger is not something, and so on. This is the end of a possible ontological liberalism, a world with one thing at a time and a world which is absolutely flat. Why? Because we now have entities without intensity. Because you have just one thing at a time in this world, you cannot compare something to something else. At least you would have two things. You can have only one thing. If you cannot have one thing, you cannot have something being more or less in the world than something else, because you can never compare something to something else. So you know, by the negative, that each thing is equally something. You know that each thing is equal in the world. Everything's there. Anything is there. Anything is in the world. No more, no less. So you can conceive of absolutely non-intense entities. An absolutely non-intense entity is a something. And the something is something alone, equal, exclusive. Each something, each thing, is distinct, for it's abstracted from all that it is not. But it's not different, for it never exists in another thing. The price to pay for conceiving that anything, absolutely anything, is in the world is that there is only one thing all at once. Things are therefore equally things,
they are not equivalent, since they are incomparable. They are each something, they are not different from each other, and they no longer have identity. Nothing is such a thing, it's only something. This is the promise of modernity, the possibility to think that absolutely no matter what is something. Well, at the end of the promise of modernity, what do we get? We get flatness, absolute flatness, non-intensity. Flatness is absolute equality. We have entities which are absolutely equal and absolutely exclusive. Equal, but non-comparable. You cannot compare something to something else. Because you cannot compare something to something else, it's not interchangeable things. You have not some kind of universal equivalence. You have no economics of things. Because you have only one thing. To have economics, you need two things. To have one thing against another. But in this world, you have only one thing at a time. So no economical process possible in this world. So at the end of an ontological liberalism, we do find the absolute contrary of liberalism, the impossibility of exchanging things, the impossibility of equivalence. We do get equality when we no longer have equivalence. Equality is not equivalence. Equality is the impossibility of equivalence, because it's absolute singularity, in fact. Well, what is in the world? Things, or rather, a thing. If one asks oneself where to find something, the answer will always be outside, in the world, and never in itself or in another thing. Maybe you know about this beautiful text of Sartre about Husserl. Well, Sartre is trying to explain what intentionality is by Husserl. Sartre is saying, well, if I could get in someone's consciousness, I would just learn how to get out of this consciousness, because each consciousness is consciousness of something. If I could enter a consciousness, I would just get out of this consciousness. What I'm trying to do is to say that, in fact, there is absolutely no, we have absolutely no right to preserve this intentionality and to only attribute it to consciousness, because each thing is out of itself, because each thing is in the world. So each thing, in fact, to be in something would always be to get out of that something, because nothing is in itself. Each thing is in the world. So to be in something would be to learn how to get in the world in the way that that something is in the world. To be the table would be to learn how to be in the world in the way of the table. To be you would be to learn how to get out of you in the world the way you are in the world, and so on and so on. So we have a world of things where each thing is outside itself. You have no in itself, no substance, nothing is in itself. Anything is outside itself in the world. You have just one thing at a time, and all these things are equal and exclusive. When you have one thing, you cannot have something else. You cannot have something other. Well, let's say that this very poor and flat world is the absolute achievement of the promise of modernity. So our katabasis has found an end. But this end is not the ground of being. It's not a ground. It's just a gauge line, just a line. Flatness is a line of being. Flatness is a gauge line of being. This is a way we can measure variable intensities, because we can think, because of speculation and abstraction, we can think of absolute equality, which is flatness. This flatness is not very important, because this flatness doesn't matter. Why? Because it's about no matter what. It's about the fact that no matter what is something. So to think the end of the promise of modernity is to think about what doesn't matter. What doesn't matter is the fact that no matter what is something. And it's the fact that being is weak. Being is weak. Why? Because if you de-determinate all ontological constraints, you find the possibility that absolutely no matter what is something, in the sense of the something that we define. Well, no, we can think of something absolutely non-intense. This is a something. So the promise of modernity as an ontological liberality has an end. And you can feel now why on why the ontological liberality is always working against itself. Because at the end of ontological liberality, you have the contrary of liberalism. You have the contrary of universal equivalence. You have the lonely thing, something that you cannot exchange against something else. So if we reach, by thinking, the end of ontological liberalism, then we can see that liberalism is never at its own level, because the real level of liberalism is flatness. Now that we have flatness, now that we can think about flatness, we have reached the end of the katabasis of the mind in the modern way. But now, what we need is an anabasis. Now that we have achieved our katabasis, we have something like a line, which is not the ground. We will not do a metaphysics that could be grounded on our ontology. You know, that would be a classical way of doing the things, just searching for a ground of being, then why to ground a new, to build a new metaphysic grounded in being. We have no ground, we have just a line. Because ontology is just the flattening, it's just flattening metaphysics. Metaphysics is about the relation between things, and it's about intensities and differences of extension, and it's about identity, difference, extensity, and intensity. Ontology is flattening metaphysics, because ontology is just trying to determinate entities and to get entities without intensities and entities without identities. It's just to get what? To get a point of Archimedes, an Archimedean point of no intensity, of flatness. So ontology is flattening metaphysics. And you cannot build metaphysics on ontology, because ontology is still metaphysics. It's just a flat metaphysics. Then, if you have flatness, if you have a flat metaphysics, what you need is an anabasis. That means we know what we need now is to deduce differences, identities, extensities, and intensities from flatness. Well, our katabasis into the underworld of the something is over. We need now to go back to multiplicity, identity, difference. We need to have objects, in object determinations, extensity and intensity. But we have a problem, because we have lose all substance of things, and we have lose the possibility that some entities possess their identity in themselves and by themselves, because our something is out of itself, deprived of itself, exiled of itself in the world. That means, how can we get some identities and some intensity now that we have a flat world of things and of empty things? Because if, as we said at the beginning, intensity is something like something compared to itself, if that something has no substance, well, how can we get intensity anymore? So, what we need is an anabasis, a metaphysical anabasis, to get identities and intensity from flatness. But if the thing is no longer substantial, its state cannot be compared to its essence. There's no essence anymore to what it's in itself. Thus, at any moment in its development, for example, a tree is comparable to the fully developed tree in such a way that I can tell what stage a tree has currently reached in the deployment of its full potentiality, with the aim of attaining its perfect state, which in some way would be contained within itself, as the form was inscribed in its matter by Aristotle. But neither is a tree a portion of matter on which a system of forces is exerting itself, like in modern science, which would cause it to vary and which would explain its metabolism, its subcirculation, and the gravitational force opposing its growth. Well, what we know is that the tree is something different at every moment in all the relationships it can have. The question, therefore, is why is today's tree yesterday's tree? Why is each part of the tree? Why is the tree that you see, the tree that I see, the same? Or rather, why don't all these distinct things have the same relationship between them as the tree could equally well have with the beehive a few meters away, or a dog, or absolutely something else. This is now the mystery of identity in a world of things emptied of their substance, without potentiality or actuality. Because potentiality inscribed identity in the matter of each substance, and actuality inscribed it in undifferentiated matter, cut up into extensive substances. Well, modern desubstantialization of the world gives us a world devoid of potentiality and actuality, and constrains us to seek another kind of identity for things. If we do recognize that nothing exists in itself, the mind is led to think that everything that exists is present in something else other than itself. But then how could no matter what entity still be what it is? As it is desubstantialized, it seems that nothing could have an identity anymore, and that nothing could have an intensity anymore. Well, let's try, in our anabasis back to intensity from flatness, let's try to have a first step. That first step would be extensity. Not intensity, but just extensity. Well, let's imagine a universe where the things are not alone, but where each thing is in another thing. Each object is in another object, in another object, in another object. It's not about lonely things anymore. Now we have objects in another object, in another. My finger is in my hand is in my body, and so on and so on. Well, is that in that universe, each thing has an identity as long as it belongs to something else. My finger is a part of my hand. My hand is a part of my body. My body is a part of the biosphere, for example, and so on and so on. Let's try to think that in this possible universe that we will call a purely extensive universe, each thing is in relation to something else. But could there be any kind of identity or intensity in that universe? If everything really is present in something else than itself, well, by affirming, for example, that I am what I am immediately signifying that I am in myself, and yet, in believing that I am identifying myself, I am already distinguishing two myself. The myself that contains myself, and the myself that is contained by myself. Thus, even the logical identity would be, in our universe, the minimal difference between that which contains and that which is contained. There are then two possibilities. Either I consider that myself is in myself as in other things, or I consider that myself is in myself as in itself. But because we have given up what things could be in themselves, I must immediately dismiss the second possibility. I cannot be in myself as something could be in itself. There is no in itself, because as something, I have to be out of myself. So I cannot be in myself as in myself. I can just be in myself as in something else. That means that my relation to myself is the same relation that my relation to the chair, for example, or to even something non-existent or something contradictory. That means that I am a stranger to myself as well as I am a stranger to anything else. But in this case, my conception is of a universe in a process of dissemination or extreme pollination. Because at the moment that I identify anything at all, I am implicitly relating that thing to a certain new thing. In even recognizing my own face, I am identifying that face, but I am merely creating an additional face, a new object, the identified face, which adds itself to the face that I have identified it with. So on the one hand, there's a face who has been identified, and on the other, the face who is the result of this identification, who is as though repeated. My face is therefore never the same, because its logical identification presupposes the doubling of an identified face, but who is not yet identical to itself, an identical face who is no longer the identified face. Well, we shall call that a purely extensive universe. we could conceive of a universe of pure extensity where each entity would be part of another, that would be part of another, and so on. Here, nothing, absolutely nothing, would ever belong to itself, but anything would belong to something else. Being absolutely unidentifiable, each entity related to itself would already be another one, and another one, and another one. Extensity is the name of this endless, nightmarish extension of entities without identity and without intensity. Well, my finger is in my hand, it's a part of my hand. But coming back from my hand and going back to my finger, I would never find the same finger. It would already be another one, and then another one, and then another one. It's like, you know, when you're a child drawing without lifting your pen. If you go back to some line, you are already drawing another line, a second one, on the first one. In our purely extensive universe, you can never go back to the same point. Nothing can never be the same. It's extensive. This is the definition of extensity, because it's an ever-expanding universe. In this case, in our expanding and extensive universe, identification and re-identification turn out to be impossible. Every time I believe I can identify something, I am at the same time distinguishing a supplementary version of it, which I cannot prevent myself from creating. In that world, nothing is in itself and nothing is ever identifiable. Well, I am something, but the one I am a second later is something else. If I am me, I is one thing, me is still another and another. This is what would happen if, for example, A was in A equal A, as in absolutely everything else. All things would combine without anything being able to be ever identical to anything else. Hence, nothing could ever be more or less what it is, because nothing could be what it is. For example, to take one example by Bergson, my pain could not become stronger in as much as it would remain non-identifiable with itself. If I'm suffering, well, each of my pains would turn out to be a distinct pain, and one would end up with the apparent paradox that everything would indeed be comparable, but in as much as nothing would ever be identifiable, this comparison would not produce the slightest difference in intensity. So, we are representing a strange universe in which, unlike the antique or classical universe, nothing has a substance, but in which nothing is more intense either, unlike what a contemporary mind would like to believe. In truth, in this precise configuration, nothing is in itself, everything is in something else, everything is extensive, but nothing has any intensity because nothing can vary, because nothing is identical. I could, of course, compare my pain to itself if I'm suffering, and I could consider that my pain at a given moment was stronger than at another, but this operation would hardly be different to the one consisting in recognizing that one man is taller than another. By comparing two extensions from the outside, I can measure them, but they are not intensities, because both men, the tall one and the short one, are different, as my pains would be. Short pain and big pain. The little pain and the big pain would be like the short man and the tall man. From the outside, there would be no intensity, because each pain would be a distinct something. And I could never identify a pain to another pain. I could never identify a suffering to another suffering. I could measure them, but my suffering, each time distinct from itself, could neither increase nor diminish in intensity, but simply appear bigger or smaller from the outside to a second suffering that would never be mine. In that perfectly extensive universe, there would appear different and comparable extensions, but nothing identifiable and nothing ever intense. Would this be the sign that there exists some secret affinity between intensity and identity? Because for there to be intensity and tension, something has to be more than something else, and this something and something else also have to be identical. Therefore, as a conclusion, in order to recognize intensity, in order to deduce what intensity is, one has to have an identity that is neither substantial nor extensive. Intensity is not substantial, it's not about being in itself or being itself, and it's not about extensity. Extensity is just an external relation between two things, one being part of another, but where all things have an identity, but nothing is ever identifiable. Which means that, contrary to what Bergson considered, for example, intensity is not what happens as soon as there is no longer a container-container relationship between two sensations. This is a definition by Bergson. No, it is a pure difference that Deleuze wanted to obtain, as if by alchemy. Well, intensity is not pure difference. It's not pure quality, as we are used to think now. Intensity is a formula of identity in a modern world devoid of substances, in which nothing can never be equal to itself. Either each thing contains itself and is therefore superior to itself, or it's contained by itself and therefore inferior to itself. Because there is no in itself, no substance, nothing nests within in itself, which means that what contains and what is contained will never be the same thing. Yet, if they are absolutely two distinct things, well, nothing would ever be identifiable or re-identifiable anymore. Intensity is precisely the tension resulting from this contradiction. What contains myself and what is contained by itself, myself, cannot be a single thing, because I am not in myself. I am no substance. There is no substance. There's just things. So what contains and what is contained, myself and myself, cannot be the same myself. There is no substance. But they cannot be two distinct things. Because if they are two distinct things, myself is to myself what myself is to the room, what the room is to the city, what the city is to us, and so on and so on, in our purely extensive universe, where something is in something else, in something else, in something else, where anything has an identity, but nothing is ever an identity. So the tension is exactly between these two options. I cannot be in myself, and I cannot be in myself as in something else. Well, the sole solution, which is also the key to our contemporary conception, is intensity as identity. The thing is more or less what it is, in such a way that any entity compared, related to itself, is intense. Related to myself, I'm intense. The chair related to itself is intense, because the chair related to itself is always a bit more or a bit less what it is. It cannot be in itself. There is no substantial chair. And it cannot be absolutely something else. The chair cannot be to itself what the chair is to, I don't know, any animal in Africa. This intensity, this constraint of intensity, this tension between a thing and itself that cannot be itself, is not necessarily subjective, and it does not concern only the thing compared to itself by my mind that identifies it. Time, for example, is a variation of intensity of things which needs neither thinking, sensation, nor life to reproduce. So, intensity, this tension of identity, is not produced by cognitive operations, by the mind. Even if there was absolutely no subjectivity, still there would be some intensity in the world and some identity in the world. And the first one would be time. Why? Time is precisely a constraint on the presence of things. Time is the fact that there is a tension between each thing and each thing. Because the minimal difference between something and something is the fact that some time passes. The minimal difference between the chair and the chair is the fact that, well, there's a first chair at time one and a second chair at time two. So we can conceive of time as an ontological constraint between things. Time is a constraint that makes of two things one thing. One thing which is becoming, naturally. Well, we can see that we are now doing some metaphysics again. This is not the end of metaphysics. Because what is metaphysics? Metaphysics is the anabasis of the mind. Coming from ontology, ontology, what is ontology? Ontology is the flattening of metaphysics. Ontology is the end of the catabasis of the mind. The catabasis is the fact that the modern mind is going to the underworld of objects, trying to find a maximal determination of things, trying to find the naked something. At the end, what we find is flatness, flatness of the world, a world where there is only one thing at a time. And then doing some metaphysics is going up again, making some anabasis of the mind and trying to find some intensities like time, the living. So trying to deduce extensity, intensity, time, the living from what? From a world of flat things, of things which are absolutely equally the same. So as we can see, we now have found an end to modernity and an end to the contemporary. Well, we could say that the contemporary in general was an endless anabasis to intensity. The contemporary age was marked by the will, the wish to of an anabasis to intensities, differences. Why? To find some pure differences, some pure intensities. But at the end, what the contemporary mind finds, it's just some empty differences and some intensities of what? Of nothing. And at the same time, modernity was an endless catabasis to the something. Well, modernity was not achievable. You cannot achieve modernity because modernity was acted by a liberal ontology that was working against itself. So at the same time, we have to find an end to modernity. The end of modernity is flatness. This is the end of the catabasis of the mind going to the underworld of ontology, of objects. And we have to find a sense to the contemporary anabasis, the quest of intensities. And as we said at the beginning, the contemporary mind is condemned to find that everything is intense, so nothing is intense, so it's depressed. So if we do not want to be depressed, like the contemporary mind, we have to think depression, not to feel it. Not to feel depression, we have to think depression as an ontological depression. Depression is just the end of the modern catabasis of the mind, trying to look for flatness, for universal equivalence. But at the end of universal equivalence, you find what? You find a soul thing, something that is alone, that cannot be exchanged against something else. So if we can think of flatness, we can think of depression. Depression, well, we can think that absolutely no matter what is something. Well, we can think that it doesn't, that nothing matters more or less than anything else. This is a key formula to depression. But if we can think this depression, well, we won't feel it anymore. So our operation is quite simple. To find an end to the catabasis, to the modern catabasis of the mind, flatness, and then to find a sense to the anabasis of the contemporary mind, which is trying to find some intensities, but there can be intensities if and only if we dispose of something non-intense. Why? To have a gauge line of intensities. We can recover the sense of intensities in our life only if and only if we are able to think absolute non-intensity. Well, as a conclusion, what is an intensity? Well, Bergson, Whitehead, Deleuze, and the contemporary world in general promised us some intensity at the end of the anabasis of the mind. The mind could elevate and find something more and more intense, an universal intensification of the world. But we did find that universal intensification of the world was in fact flattening of the world. And what we need is to accept this flattening of the world and to think it as an ontological flat world. So what is an intensity? Intensity is not pure difference, as we thought. It's not pure quality. No, intensity is minimal identity. Far from being neutral, this is what the classical mind thought. The classical mind thought that, in fact, identity was neutral. A equal A is neutral. Okay. Far from being neutral, every identity, logical time identity, every identity is a tension that is maintaining together entities about to disseminate themselves into myriad of distinct things absolutely indifferent to one another. Logical identity, temporal identity, and organic identity are several versions of what makes a single object out of several things. Me. But just one me. This is identity and this is intensity. Because each version of me is a distinct thing. Because we know that that we should allow absolutely each thing to be something. So I have to allow me now to be something, and me now to be something else, and me now to be something else, and each part of me to be something else. So we know in our flat world that absolutely each thing is something. What is identity? It's an ontological constraint, a tension, that of many things, me, of many versions of things, which are distinct things, makes one object. But that object cannot eliminate the fact that in that object you have many possible things always on the verge of exploding. Because in each thing, in the chair here, you have an infinite amount of version of the chair that are about to be distinct things. Not distinct versions of the chair, but distinct things. At each moment, each chair in the chair could be a stranger to another version of the chair, like the chair would be to the wall, like the wall would be to something else, So identity, what is identity? It's minimal tension, is intensity, is the fact that some things are not in themselves, because there is no substance on the chair. The risk is the fact that at each moment, each thing is about to explode. And identity is a non-explosion of an object. Is a tension that just shows us that some things are linked to each other while remaining distinct things. Not being one, but not being two absolutely strange to each other objects. So, since nothing is ever absolutely itself, everything is always subjected to variation. And everything compared to itself, well, a thing is never mistaken for itself. Neither the pure logical replaceability, nor the identity through time, nor the immunitory identity of a living organism can assure us that two things are really one. Two things never being absolutely the same, because no matter what is something, and because each thing is something else, well, their minimal identity is always a tension. A tension between self and self in the logical identity, a tension of the presence of the thing in the temporal identity, a tension between what maintains and what transgresses the self in the organic identity. It's because nothing is equal to itself, and this is a result of the katabasis of the mind, that every entity is always intensely identical, which is to say that its identity is systematically an infinite variation. Everything can have an identity or be an identity. To have an identity is to be an entity subjected to variation. To be an identity is to be the variation itself, the change from one entity to another. Well, I think that the contemporary mind is always dreaming of being a wandering intensity, of being an identity without ever having one identity. On the contrary, the modern mind as some identity, the passion of the modern mind is belonging. The modern mind wants to belong to something, belonging to something else. Modern mind wanted to belong to a party, to a nation, to family, to something, to belong to something else than yourself. So the modern mind wants to belong, so to have an identity, and the contemporary mind wants to be an identity without belonging. I do think that with our katabasis and anabasis of the mind, we can now escape from this kind of impasses of identity, of the classical, the modern, and the postmodern or contemporary mind. We could say this. A classical mind always needs a world of substances, of things in itself, of more than things and less than things, substances, predicates. Because the classical mind, or the reactionary mind, wants a cosmos, a hierarchization of things. A modern mind doesn't recognize substances anymore. For the modern mind, there is nothing in itself anymore. Modern mind calls for our purely extensive universe, where anything is belonging, anything has an identity, without ever being an identity. A postmodern or contemporary mind sees nothing but intensities, pure intensities. It lives in a purely intensive universe where anything is an identity, but nothing as one. Well, to escape these three impasses, I wanted to show you that we need a catabasis, which is ontology, to find a non-intense something, deprived of any determination. And at the same time, we do need an anabasis, back to intensities from a world of no intensity. So we do need ontology as a catabasis and metaphysics as an anabasis. From the universe of extensity and intensity to the underworld of the naked something of ontology and back to the universe of identities, differences and intensities of metaphysics, we can find a way to handle with entities without identities and to recover a sense of identities, the one entities have and the one entities are. We can feel ourselves like things among things, like living being among the living, like humans among humans. This is the way I see speculative thinking as well as Pierre Wick's work, a constant catabasis to end modernity and a constant anabasis to end postmodernity, from the real to the ring, going through the possible, downhill to the ontological flatness of things, up the hill to the variation of time and the living, to the variation of intensities. Downhill to equality, up the hill to intensity. This is the way. Thank you.